When I saw the old picture of me, I thought, one way of keeping young is just not to update your picture on your website. So I was delighted when Scott asked me to make a presentation, and then I started to get a little bit nervous. So positive energy will be welcomed. So I was asked to talk about creating an equitable educational system. And so what I want to do is give you a guide to the presentation, which is about, I'm first going to talk about funding philosophy. So many of what I'm going to say is going to echo what Tom discussed so comprehensively and fully. I was thinking, oh, I should have you come and speak to my school finance class. Goals of fairness in distribution, methods of distribution, implications for equity. Talk about the general case of how these concepts are applied in Minnesota. Give you two empirical examples that my students and I have conducted with regard to equity in Minnesota. Talk about equity implications, and then conclude with some remarks. So now, if you ever took school finance with me, this saying will sound familiar. Renee's already saying that. Budgets are human values with price tags. So as you think about a budget, what you're really thinking about are the values that we're willing to invest in. School finance system, same thing. What are the values that we're willing to invest in order to get particular outcomes? So one way of looking at that is that we have various funding philosophies. And so as a state, you may think the primary reason for the state to get involved is to support need, to address need. Another you may think about is the primary role of the state is to reward output or incentivize output. Another reason may be to reward effort. And then the goals of distribution of these funds fall into five main categories among school finance scholars. It was very helpful to hear Dr. Melcher's presentation and hear about the mechanics of it. I'm going to focus a bit more on the philosophy of it. And you're thinking, that's all I need at 8 o'clock in the morning is a philosophy. But okay, thank you. And so as Dr. Melcher talked about, horizontal equity is about equally situated entities being treated equally. And so many of you as educators may be saying to yourself, I don't have equally situated children. All my children are unique, and all my children have different needs and come from different contexts. But as policymakers, you recognize that you need to have some structure in which to have a systemic and systematic way of funding schools. So one way to kind of get at the uniqueness of kids is the vertical equity, where you say, I'm going to have differently situated entities be treated differently. So horizontal equity may say all third graders should be treated as third graders, whatever that looks like. Vertical equity recognizes that not all third graders are the same. That a third grader's experience in Bemidji may look very different from a third grader's experience in Minneapolis. And what the two philosophies of equity try to get at is that we should treat students, we should treat children equally unless we can articulate a reason why we are treating them differently. So horizontal equity calls for equal treatment, vertical equity calls for different treatment for differently situated entities. Adequacy just says to us as school finance scholars that we have a branding issue. Because when I say to educators that we're looking for adequacy, they often say that's too little. That what we want our students to do is to excel. But adequacy for school finance scholars is about how are we investing in our educational system so that most students, if not all, can meet what we consider high standards. This is what the Skeen lawsuit was about, an adequacy. And in school finance, we have various ways of getting at adequacy. We ask professionals, well, what do you think you need in order to get adequate investment in your school finance system? We may run statistical analyses and say, well, how much does it typically cost for schools that we consider well-functioning to do what they're doing? We may look at successful schools and say, well, what are the successful schools doing? And so there are various ways that we try and think about what is the appropriate investment that we need to do to get into schools or to invest well into schools. And then we have fiscal neutrality, which is saying we should not be able to tell how much we're spending on a child simply by knowing that child's zip code. Right? And so fiscal neutrality, you can feel free to applause if you're right. Okay. So if fiscal neutrality is really getting at the notion of how are we spending on kids? How are we valuing kids? But once you have come up with the goals of what it is that we want our education finance system to do, we also have to consider how are we going to do it. And Dr. Melcher talked a lot about how are we going to do it, the mechanics of it. And so typically in school finance, we have three or four major ways of distributing funds. We can say we're going to have a flat grant, where state funds all jurisdictions at the same rate. We could have a foundation grant, which is what Dr. Melcher described as having the state contribute a certain portion and the districts contribute a certain portion. And so both states and district contribute, and what you're doing is trying to create a floor below which no district falls. We have a guaranteed tax base where state funds districts so that district effort is rewarded in some way, that if you're willing to tax yourself at a certain percentage rate, the state will kick in an equalizing portion within reason so that a rich district or more wealthy district isn't going to get more resources for the same effort as a poor district would. So all of this is really our attempt of trying to treat our citizens equitably. And in Minnesota, because we're so nice, we do all. There's some portion or some version of that, except for the foundation. The structure of the foundation is still there. But the flat grant guaranteed tax base is what we're essentially having in various portions of the school finance system. So here are the equity implications of choosing these options. If you choose a flat grant, many scholars in the field say that's good in that you're not really worrying about lower capacity districts being able to afford to fund their schools. The challenge with flat grants is that then as a state you'll have to fund it at sufficiently high levels so that districts who can afford to spend more don't want to spend more or don't feel the need to spend more. Because once you have districts coming in to say, we need to spend more to serve the needs of our kids, then you have the differential capacity of districts playing a role and then having fiscal neutrality being compromised. And it may be costly to fund all districts at a high enough level so that more wealth districts do not add on a lot more. Foundation grants, our costs are shared between state and districts. Basic funding levels may be higher for the reasons that Dr. Melcher noted. You're more able to increase your general or your basic revenue if you're not having to foot the bill for all of that basic education revenue, and that you can share some of these costs with localities. Guaranteed tax base, one of the challenges with guaranteed tax bases is that if you're saying I'm going to reward effort, what you're guaranteeing is effort, not spending levels. And so you still may have a challenge where you have different spending choices among a variety of districts for a variety of reasons. And so it's not surprising that in Minnesota, you try and get the best of each strategy by combining them. And so I thought of Minnesota as a Ragu commercial. It's in there. So as you noted from Dr. Melcher's presentation, if you look down the list of contents for the financing education in Minnesota, what you'll see is that they have the general education program revenue, and then within that, they have a lot of subcategories. And then they have categorical aid. And all of this is because our school finance is a reflection of the values and what we think we need to equalize or what we need to fund differently. And here are the examples in the school finance formula of how we reflect those values, where we say horizontal equity and adequacy. In our general education revenue, we have set portions in the basic formula allowance of what each district will get per pupil unit. The very notion that we have a pupil unit instead of just a regular pupil is another example of how we're trying to recognize equity, because we're saying there's something about secondary school students that require more resources than students in elementary or middle school. So throughout our document, we are having examples of our attempt to try and get at treating differently situated entities differently, treating equally situated entities equally, and trying to make sure that we're not projecting or predicting a student's expenditure by where that student lives. So now I want to kind of talk a little bit more about two empirical analyses that I did with my students in terms of, well, what does that look like in reality? So I think Minnesota has done quite a good job in acknowledging some of the differential needs. And I wanted, but in some places, I think, to use Dr. Melcher's words, it may need improvement, right? And so one of the things that we do a lot of, if you look back at this, we think about differently situated entities a lot in terms of sparsity. So we fund elementary sparsity. We fund transportation sparsity. We fund secondary sparsity. And so why do we fund sparsity? Because we think because they have fewer students, it's going to cost more per student, so they need more resources. But as metropolitan school districts, you probably are also saying, you know, our density also comes at a price. Our local market means that there are higher costs for providing services. And so we, with the encouragement of Scott, I was trying to figure out where he is, the encouragement of Scott, we looked at what is a differential cost among school districts within Minnesota. And we thought we came up with a clever title. You may not think it's as clever, Locating Equity. Okay, thank you for that nod. And so in Minnesota, the wage differentials with teachers, and teachers, as you know, is the bulk of the cost. Well, salaries are the bulk of the cost because it's a service. Education is a service industry. I shouldn't use the term industry, but okay. We provide services. And so there's a 25-point difference between the highest cost markets and the lowest cost markets. And if any of you participated in the Black Friday sale, you realize 25% can mean quite a lot of your bottom line. And if you're not participating in that 25% off, that may also mean quite a lot for your bottom line. And so if you saw here, suburban average $45,000 for teachers, in urban average $42,000, average for the state $41,000, average for rural areas $30,000. That adds up. And so we ask these questions. What are the average cost disparities among school districts within Minnesota? How is the purchasing power of school districts affected by those cost disparities? Because that's why we care. It's about how is it that we're going to purchase these services in order to provide programs for our kids. So the reason why Dr. Meldra looked at inflation-adjusted cost and revenues as he showed those graphs is because we recognize that a dollar today buys less than what a dollar did 2 years ago or 10 years ago. What we are talking about is a dollar in Bemidji may buy more than what a dollar in Minneapolis can buy. And what we were trying to do is to figure out how much more can it buy. Because how much more it can buy can determine how much more educators have to buy in terms of Minneapolis versus other districts or other metropolitan places. And so we also wanted to know what are the implications for the state's overall school expenditures if they use a location equity index that captures geographic cost differences. Because we recognize we're not existing in a vacuum. Somebody's going to have to pay for what we are seeing our extra costs. And so we had two methods. The geographic cost of education index that was initially created by students at Hamline, and then we updated it. And so what we're really looking at is to say, if 77% of the costs are from salaries, then look at the labor market for that county. Look at that labor market for that region, and then see how much we would have to change. What is the differences in costs that are associated with that? We also looked at a comparable wage index, which Dr. Taylor at University of Texas created, where she said, what is the competition for teachers? If teachers and other professionals are able to go to other markets, how much would we as educators have to pay them for them to be able to come to ours, for them to choose teaching? And so we had these two methods, and we said, using GCEI, which is a General Cost Education Index, 50% of students live in a district with a lower than average purchasing power. If we use the CWI, the Comparable Wage Index, 60% of Minnesota students live in a district with a lower than average purchasing power, which is another way of saying 40% of students live in those districts, 50% of those students live in districts at higher than average costs. And when I say children live in those districts, we're not necessarily saying that they're 50% districts, because metropolitan areas tend to have higher densities. So how is the purchasing power of districts affected by these cost disparities? The Geographic Cost of Education Index identifies 47 districts that have lower purchasing power of each dollar received because of higher labor costs. These costs range from 1 to 12% above the state average. These numbers indicate the additional basic general education revenue these districts require to be able to buy the same services as those communities with an index equaling one. For example, Bloomington needs $638.68 per pupil more than districts with an index of one to purchase the same quantity and quality of goods or services. If you start multiplying it by the number of students in Bloomington, that's starting to add up quite a bit. If you use this comparable wage index, what we find is that 76 districts would require additional support in order for their purchasing power to match those of the average labor cost district. And so Anoka would need $298.16 per pupil more than districts with personnel costs mirroring the state average. And so what are the implications? If the state, in addition to looking at sparsity and recognizing that having low density matters, also considers having high labor cost matters, what would be the implications using these numbers? That would mean a 3.5% increase in basic general education revenue spending. CWI would require a 2.6% increase in the basic general education revenue to have those numbers matched. So again, I'm going back to this notion that we're thinking that if you have differently situated entities, we need to treat them differently. And quite often in the literature, we think about differently situated in terms of student need, district capacity to serve those needs, and the programs that we're offering to fill those needs. So I talked about the geographic index in terms of district capacity and the purchasing power of districts. I want to switch gears now to student need. And a recent study that we have great students at the University of Minnesota, that University of Minnesota student Song Tae Jang, who's now working at the University of Hong Kong, did in terms of balancing equity and efficiency, and to see how Minnesota fulfills those concerns. So I think Tom's graph beforehand showed that there's an uneven distribution of English learners across the state. And you can look at it and you can recognize that metropolitan districts typically have the highest percentages of English learners. If you look across the state, there is also high poverty primarily in inner urban areas, although suburban areas are now having more poverty. Rural districts also have fairly high poverty. So the highest poverty regions are typically urban areas and rural districts. And what I'm trying to show here is Minnesota, in its school financing mechanism, acknowledges that students who come from households that may not have a lot of money or who are eligible for free and reduced lunch prices, that they may require different resources than children who do not come or who are not eligible for free and reduced lunch prices. And so if you look at the portion of FRL, free and reduced lunch lunch eligible students, the state has done a good job over the time period examined of making sure that there are more money given to those districts that have higher portions of students who are eligible for subsidized lunch. On our right, we see that's not so much for English learners. That one, there may not be more funding for those districts that have higher portions of EL students. And even when there's significant associations, those associations are not in the direction that we would have expected. You'd have expected if you have English learners, you have higher portions, you should get more funding. What we see here in the associations is that not only do they get less, they get significantly less. Looking at instructional expenditures, the same pattern persists. That with regard to poverty, as poverty increases, the amount of money that the state awards goes up. For EL students, as a portion increases, not so much, or not at all. And so what this figure shows is that if you look at equality, just in the general sense, looking at what are two-thirds, what's happening to two-thirds of the students, you'll realize from 2003 to 2010, and that pattern I think is pretty consistent even now, equality overall in terms of horizontal equity has gone up and then has gone down. And that what we're seeing is that districts that are spending below the median are typically falling farther behind. So some takeaways from those two empirical analyses is that state efforts to achieve vertical equity, to treat differently situated entities differently, vis-a-vis poverty, seems to be paying off for total and instructional expenditures per pupil. The magnitudes of those associations are more pronounced for total expenditures. State efforts to achieve fiscal vertical equity vis-a-vis English learners needs improvement. For the most part, districts with higher portions of ELL get less expenditures per pupil, not more. And I also wanted to point out that while Minnesota has provisions to address high need, such as poverty, these efforts are somewhat muted in metropolitan areas because we don't take into account differential costs. So looking to the future. Given that resources spent on instruction may have more direct implications for students' schooling experiences, state policymakers could explore policy designs that result in stronger positive associations between instructional expenditures and fiscal resources. Our school finance system, I would conclude with this, typically looks at school finance and equity in a procedural way, where we're trying not to have more wrongs. We're trying to do right from now until the future. Crenshaw advocates us having a more expansive view of equity, where we not only look at not doing wrongs in the future, but correcting the wrongs of the past. And we do that to some extent with our integrative revenue, but that's a very small portion. And for the reasons that Dr. Melcher cited, our best efforts quite often becomes muted because of the small portions that we contribute to these efforts. So what I propose is that we've typically focused on fiscal neutrality, where we are asking our education finance system to invest in students in a way that where a student lives doesn't typically predict how much will be spent on a student. And what I'm asking is if we can probably move even beyond that and have results neutrality, so that who our students are won't predict how well they do in our schools. Thank you.
Wow. Are you willing to take questions?
I'm definitely willing to take questions, if you have them.
First of all, thank you for the presentation. That was powerful, and for myself, it left me wondering the influence of the court case Cruz-Guzman and the unintentionality of the decisions we were making. And I think these two presentations, one by Dr. Melcher and yourself, just played hand in hand, because as we've gone through from a legislative standpoint, and I think people have great intentions, but the results, the outcomes, and when I look at Cruz-Guzman, does this have some validity in terms of at least pushing for further discussions of how could we get to that outcome neutrality?
I'm trying to think if I can just put back to this
If we now recognize that equity and equality are not necessarily the same thing, how is it that we can invest in our students that also recognize that we not only are moving from here forward, we also have to kind of look back at the structural inequities that existed, so that there are different starting points for students that we will need to address, that addressing now to the future doesn't necessarily get at sufficiently. I don't know if I addressed that. Okay, sorry. We're shying away from lawsuits kind of proclamations. So I know that was a very politically kind of answer.
Right. I'm sorry that you're shying away from lawsuits. I'm a school board member and a lawyer, so you're gonna see where my brain goes in a second. But I appreciate very much what you're bringing forward. But I think it's important to link it back to the first slide in Dr. Melcher's presentation. We have a state constitution that speaks to a policy that we have adopted as our constitutional policy, mm-hmm. which I think references concepts that you're bringing forward around this results neutrality, because I think it's been very easy for us in our political culture to look at equity in terms of equality and look at it as in terms of the uniformity part of it has to be based on all of the inputs being the same and treating everybody as the same. What I think is the challenge, the political challenge, is our state doesn't look the same as it did 20 or 40 or 60 years ago. So what it means to provide a uniform education and the kind of equity that's required and the kind of equality of access and opportunity that it requires needs something more. It needs a different construct for people to have a conversation, and it's a less comfortable conversation to have in our political culture because it means recognizing difference in ways that I think have been very uncomfortable over the years in our state's political culture. And now we're moving into a phase where that's necessary. So I'm really heartened and would love to hear you be even more visible in that conversation around results neutrality, because I really think that that is the direction that we need to go. And if there is going to be any kind of litigation strategy that speaks to what it means to uphold the constitutional principle, I think referencing the prior question, you know, we do have a recognition by our state Supreme Court that there is a right and then there is a remedy. The Cruz Guzman lawsuit is one vehicle for figuring out what that remedy might be. But it isn't the only remedy by which we can have that conversation. So how do we use the legislative process and the possibility of this principle, this constitutional principle, being part of that discussion as a way to leverage our political leadership in the state to actually reference this results neutrality and the principles in the Constitution that are embedded in it?
Thank you. Did you want me to comment? Okay, no. So I'm glad that the gentleman talked about it's one vehicle, right? So as if we talk about policy analysis, quickly, what we often say is that policy analysis is not policy evaluation. Policy analysis has to start with the problem that you have defined. And so this is where the rubber meets the road. How are we defining the problem? And I think because we have differently defined the problem and differently defined what's the role of the state in addressing however we've defined that problem, it becomes a real tug and war, which requires, and I think at least if we can have some sort of recognition that we didn't start the same place, and many times we didn't start the same place because of state and federal actions to ensure that we didn't start the same place. But I don't know necessarily if the vehicle of the Cruz Guzman is the old, as you pointed out, the only strategy that recognizes the problem in that way. Does that? Okay.
Dr. Alexander.
Hey.
Thank you for a recap of the syllabus from our course together. It was excellent. I'm actually, short question. Are you aware of states that have addressed more adequately some results neutrality and or addressing wrongs of the past, distributive justice, some of the suggestions that you've made? Are you aware of state financing systems that have already made further progress than we have in Minnesota towards those ends?
So Minnesota actually leads the pack in trying to address equity in many ways. And for some of you, you may think, okay, we got a C+ in one of the education week. And you know, it's Minnesota, we're high achievers, where all of our children are above average. We're not expecting a C+ in the education week. That said, we don't necessarily, it's a hard road to hoe to talk about how does one distinguish without discriminating. You don't necessarily want to give the impression because you have black kids and poor kids that they're less than, and that's why we have to invest more in. So it's a very sensitive conversation that one has to have. That said, I think you can recognize that there are structures that were not helpful to those kids that were, to certain kids that were marginalized for a variety of reasons. Now I get to, that was my introduction to answer your question. I don't think there are many states that explicitly address results neutrality. It took us many years to even get to the notion of addressing fiscal neutrality. And I think it will probably take us several more years to get to the notion of results neutrality, because I think what we have to make clear with results neutrality, we're not asking for there to be equal outcomes. We're asking for outcomes not to be predictable based on illegitimate reasons. And so that's the key. And I think many times the conversation goes to, oh, you want everybody to be equal. People have different talents. How is it that you're bringing communism in here? So I want to make it clear that my goal, so now I'll tip my hand. What I would like is results neutrality, because I don't want achievement to be predictable based on race, ethnicity, language abilities, poverty levels, or things that we think shouldn't matter to the talent and skills of our children. That's what I want. It doesn't necessarily mean that I'm expecting all kids to perform the same, because all kids don't perform the same. Does that? So no, that I could have just answered your question in one. I don't have any knowledge that there is any that looks at results neutrality.
Are there any other questions?
I've got another question, but to follow up quickly on your last comment, one of the things that we've been trying to look at in our district is the actual distribution of performance. So it is not predictable based on race or socioeconomic status, because there are a number of children in our district who may be Latino or maybe African American who far outperform many of our Caucasian students. And we know, for example, that all of our racial and ethnic subgroups outperform the state average by 20 to 30%. And you know, that we also far outperform Caucasian students in most other districts. So you know, we haven't solved the total disparity internally, but we certainly have solved the disparity for African American and American Indian and Alaskan and Hispanic students compared to other districts. The point I wanted to make before that editorial was that I spent about 10 years working on the Location Equity Index being part of our system. And we finally got something that wasn't exactly what we were after, but we got something. We got the $424 set aside. However, immediately the next session, the rural district said, well, you can't get that. You know, that should be everybody. So, you know, we had not embedded that difference of thinking with our legislators, and even maybe with some of our districts, that there is a difference in the cost of doing business in urban and suburban districts compared to other districts. So there are a lot of pieces that Dr. Melcher presented, that you presented, that need to be fleshed out fully, and then see how the chips fall. You know, it might help some district, it might not help some district, but the best way to do many of those things is when we're already raising the water level, we're already getting much more aid, then you can have some of those changes internally. But a lot of our problems are that we have these differences that Dr. Melcher cited and that you cited, particularly that location equity, that just have not been fully addressed. And so those of us who have that one problem might focus on that as the fix we need. Somebody else might look at another piece that's not equitable that they want to focus on. So we don't even get a common purpose, because we've got so many different pieces to our finance system that need to be addressed.
Sorry, and I think that's the crux of the matter, is that we have a fairly fixed pie, and so there's competition for these dollars that we're talking about. So as a gentleman indicated, rural areas may not appreciate you saying that we should get more funding as metropolitan districts, because we have a higher cost. And so that's a political hashing. Again, it's that budgets are human values with price tags. What is it that we value as a state, and what is it that we think are legitimate differences that we should address with resources from our state coffers? So I think that's why you don't see many of the solutions. It's because we have resources are scarce.
Dr. I first of all, let me clarify in terms of this conversation went to exactly where I thought it would go when I said let's push use Cruz Guzman to push the conversation. Yeah. We could talk about the Skeen case, and everyone in here probably go right back to it and say, oh, okay. When you bring up Cruz Guzman, that's a conversation starter. And it's also one that'll shut people down, because you're gonna have to address some realities. We're not the first place to ever to attempt to bring about some form of neutrality. When you look at Finland, Finland wasn't always high performing. They took it through the policy path to create what they have in Finland, and they really got to what is it gonna take to be excellent. We have a gap that persists between excellence and non-excellence. And we have come to, because of the Constitution that we have in the United States, has persisted on differences. It was founded on differences, and it continued to persist today in our consciousness. And we don't want to address it. Anything that looks like it may be somewhat controversial. So I'm not saying it's the only path to look at Cruz and Guzman, but I'm saying we cannot sit amongst one another and not address it. And most of us probably haven't even read it as deeply. Not that I even agree with all of it, but I've read it multiple times, and I ask you to at least, colleagues, take the time to read it, because there are some truths in it too, particularly when we begin to talk about how we set the bar, our structure, everything.